Our next case on today's oral argument docket is 525-0038, People v. Hermanson. I've got Mr. Marshall here live on behalf of the state, and I've got Ms. Cebulski, is that correct?
That is correct, thank you.
I got one right. I was 0 for 4 last time we were here.
Two for Juno?
I've done okay this morning, except I botched the entry. So, but we'll get through. Defense counsel is with us hybrid via Zoom. And are you ready to proceed?
I am ready to proceed.
Before we start, everybody can see and hear her okay?
Yes.
Okay, then go right ahead.
Great. Good morning, Your Honors, opposing counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Amy Cebulski with the Office of the State Appellate Defender, and I represent the appellant. Even as I appear before you today, no party can definitively say whether an obstructing or resisting conviction is on appeal. The state charged both offenses in one count and then painted its case in broad brushstrokes, provoking both obstructing and resisting without ever tying itself to one theory. Yet now on appeal, the state asks this court to step into the jury box and speculate which of the two offenses the jury may have seen in a legal workshop test. At issue here, however, is not whether the evidence looks reasonably sufficient for conviction, but whether a conviction for obstructing or resisting can stand in the face of due process and double jeopardy concerns due to three issues. First, the insufficient charging document. Second, the inaccurate jury instructions. And third, a verdict from a jury that was unsure of what obstructing or resisting even meant. First, because obstructing and resisting are legally distinct offenses, the state cannot hedge its bets by charging both offenses in one count. Instead, it must charge either obstructing or resisting and then tie it to the authorized act or arrest. As outlined in the brief, the information instead is deficient in multiple ways. The state has functionally conceded that the information is deficient and instead asks this court to pretend that it had charged the offense correctly. While prejudice from the deficient charging instrument must be proven here, the concerns regarding double jeopardy and the harm to Mr. Hermanson's defense were apparent throughout the trial, giving this court the basis to reverse and vacate the conviction. From the information to the end of trial, the deficient information prejudiced Mr. Hermanson's defense as the state pursued a conviction on either obstructing or resisting. Thus, the state gained the benefit of a scattershot prosecution where it could present multiple alleged instances of obstructing or resisting, as well as multiple authorized acts. By failing to tie one offense to one act per count, the state could then secure a conviction in combination of acts that might otherwise have mandated acquittal, such as a conviction based on resisting when he was not under arrest, resisting when he did not know he was under arrest, impeding in a non-material way, or through conduct that's not covered under the statute. While obstructing and resisting may seem connected, we can look to familiar examples of aggravated battery subsections based on location, weapon, or victim status for clarity. Just as the subsections on aggravated battery are not interchangeable due to their separate elements that the state must prove, a conviction for obstruction is not interchangeable with one for resisting. Charging and arguing both obstruction in one charge would actually be worse than charging two kinds of aggravated battery, as whether conduct is obstructive or resisting requires multiple subjective interpretations from the jury, rather than a simple showing of the existence of a fact, such as the victim's age. Rather than focusing on what the state was actually alleging, Mr. Hermanson thus has to defend against any and all potential conduct contained in the video, even if it's technically non-criminal. In addition to prejudicing the defense, charging the defendant in the way the state did here creates grave double jeopardy concerns. The information and verdict in this case were vague enough that the state could hypothetically pursue charges for the same criminal acts argued at trial on an alternate theory. For example, if the jury found him guilty of resisting but would have acquitted on obstruction, and this court sent it back for a new trial where the state then pursued only obstruction, he would functionally be subjected to a second trial on the same conduct. The state's own argument on appeal actually highlights how the deficient information put Mr. Hermanson at risk of double jeopardy. The state now argues that it was obstruction and not resisting that was at issue at trial, and the authorized act was his arrest and warrant despite no stipulation existing, and despite the state arguing multiple authorized acts connected to multiple alleged conduct. Essentially, it is asking this court to ignore the proceedings below and conduct a new trial and appeal because it post hoc chose which offense it actually prosecuted. Should this conduct be condoned, there would be nothing stopping the state from pursuing the same tactic at the trial level, only deciding it was charging obstruction and arrest after trial before pursuing new charges and acts that were referenced but apparently not at issue at trial. The prejudicial effect of the deficient information was intensified in the other two reversible errors at trial, the inaccurate jury instructions and the unanswered jury questions, which each on their own would require a new trial. Here, the inaccurate jury instructions did nothing to reduce the confusion on whether the state was pursuing an obstruction or resisting charge, as it left out key details from the updates that went into effect in 2023. For example, the instructions did not separate the offenses, they did not add the element of arrest to resisting, nor did it mention subsection 1D, which further requires the arrest to be pursuant to an underlying offense for which the person was initially subject to arrest. IPIs are not infallible, and as outlined in the briefing, the Illinois Supreme Court has explicitly blessed the review of IPIs through court cases such as these. To instruct the jury on the old law would allow them to impermissibly convict on a wider scope of conduct than intended by the legislature, while eliminating the ability to acquit on combinations of conduct and acts that would otherwise not support conviction. This made the trial fundamentally unfair and thus requires reversal. Further, in issue 3, the court's refusal to answer the jurors' legal questions demonstrates that the confusion in the charging documents and instructions followed the jury into deliberations. The jury asked 3 questions, including the definitions of obstructing and resisting, what a carry stop was, and if someone must produce a license if asked. These 3 questions revealed 3 things. 1, the jury did not know which offense they were supposed to consider. 2, that the jury did not know what authorized act Mr. Hermanson was accused of resisting or obstructing. And 3, that the jury was unsure of what either obstructing or resisting even meant. The jury's confusion becomes even more concerning in the context that it was told 4 times that this would be a 1-day trial. Once the court explicitly instructed the jury that we expect this to be a 1-day trial, you will get the case this afternoon, you will begin deliberations, and finish those up today. The jury may have felt like it was its job to come to a verdict that day, and in fact the jury convicted at 4:58 p.m. that day. Mr. Hermanson has a due process right to know what he was convicted of. Based on the trial court's failure to answer the jury's questions, as well as the inaccurate jury instructions, a new trial at the very least is warranted. Given the danger of double jeopardy, however, and the prejudice to Mr. Hermanson's defense from the deficient charging document, Mr. Hermanson asks this court to reverse and vacate his conviction. Do your honors have any questions?
Justice Barberis?
No.
Justice Hackett?
Not at this time, thank you.
Well, thank you, counsel. Obviously, you'll have your time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Do you have any questions before I begin? I was going to use my time today to address a few things she raised in her reply brief. I always get the chance to do that. She takes issue with the state's representation that it was all but stipulated that the officer's authorized act was to serve the outstanding warrant. Says it's a longer way of saying it's not stipulated and it warps the record. Well, I'll admit that it was not stipulated. That's why I said all the but. But I will not concede that I warped the record. It was a shorter way of saying it was undisputed. Jury couldn't have been confused about it. Most significantly, I think, part of the defense was to emphasize that the warrant was ultimately served and thus the unauthorized act or the authorized act was never truly obstructed. On page 19, I cite the opening statements, officer's testimony, the cross, and page 166 is counsel's closing argument. If I may, I would like to add page 168 as well to that. And that's where counsel specifically rhetorically asked the jury, was the defendant knowingly obstructing? Was he knowingly impeding the serving of the warrant? She might say the jury was confused because of this driver's license question, but that was just referenced in the state's closing argument. I guess I'll jump to that one, but this point about the confusion on issue three, I think all those questions were invited by the closing arguments or the Terry stop. The parties throughout the whole trial, Terry, it's all over the video. It was never described to them, so I understand why they would ask, what the heck is Terry stop? On page six, reply brief, state does not respond to the argument the information was void for duplicity. Did respond on page 16, it's rather brief. Starts defendant's intimations, and it ends with the state asking the court to compare Lauer and Hughes. Similarly, fails to respond that he was prejudiced beyond making a bare assertion that his ability to raise a defense was not impacted and the information was sufficient to bar further prosecution. That's not really a bare assertion. That's a line from a conclusory paragraph that discusses pages 13 and 18 above it. Otherwise, on issue one, I would stand on my arguments that resisting and resisted could be stricken under the applicable law, who holds Gilmore standard and surplusage, and that there was no confusion as to what the defendant was charged against.
Attorney Marshall, can I stop you there for a second?
Of course, Your Honor.
What's the substance of that argument, though? If in fact, the charging document did contain that wording, our issue isn't what if it hadn't been there. The fact is it was there. I don't know if we can say that's surplusage at that point, can we?
I think when it says obstruct, resisting or obstructing, and then they basically charged what used to just be, what is now just obstructing. Used to be called resisting or obstructing. And they chopped it and they made resisting a specific offense that requires arrest on an underlying offense. So I think everyone thought they were still proceeding under the old version, and there was no confusion about that. On appeal is when this theory arrives that, oh, they used this word, they used that word, oh, they charged two separate crimes. He didn't know what the heck he was defending against. No, it was very specific.
But the issue is that the trial proceeded with a document charging under the old statute, which had wording different than the statute in effect at the time of the offense.
But the wording kept in place the substance of the prior enactment, and the only word that remained that shouldn't be there was resisting. And that was even in the alternative, resisting or obstructing. And since obstructing includes all acts that could constitute resisting, because it's much more expansive, it would have just been charged the same way without that word resisting or resisted.
Well, going back to the attorney for the defendant's argument, what was this defendant convicted of?
Obstructing a peace officer in the performance of an authorized duty under subsection, I think it's now B. They cut it A and B, so it would be B.
The charging document says resisting or obstructing. How are we to know?
From the remainder of the charge and how it's worded is exactly how it used to just be resisting and obstructing. Now that's obstructing, and resisting is resisting a specific arrest. They basically cut it into two different offenses. And here we know it's obstructing because resisting doesn't have to be there. He can resist, and it's set out in the charging instrument exactly what he did. And all those constitute obstruction. And he was not charged with, he just was not charged with resisting an arrest. He was charged with resisting or obstructing the performance of an authorized act, which is now just obstructing the performance of an authorized act. So when he challenged it, now if he would have raised this in the trial court, made a deal about it, they could have amended it. But when he charged it, or when he challenged it the first time on appeal under Pujols-Gilmore standard, and under the surplusage, you look at it and say, okay, did he know what was going on here? Can we strike these words and make no difference? And I'm convinced that we can.
Well, to back up what you said, I think that's one of your main arguments on this issue, is that the defense counsel did not file any type of motion challenging the charge, didn't file for a bill of particulars. I don't know if it's in, or maybe this is my note, it seems like the argument's almost, by failing to do that, by proceeding to trial, the defendants either A, forfeited the issue, or invited the issue by proceeding in one manner, and then now on appeal, arguing against it.
And that is, Your Honor, I believe that's why, I believe it was just Goldenhurst's dad, that the Pujols-Gilmore standard, way back in the day, they're like, it's a different ballgame when you're waiting until on appeal, and to say, oh, this is messed up, that's messed up. It's like, what is it? The ability to prepare your defense and the ability to bar future prosecution. And I think we've got both that here in spades. I can think of something else. Oh, yeah, also, trial counsel, I think it was one of the little sidebars. He even referred to this. This is an obstruction offense we're arguing here. I don't think there was any confusion. I think the confusion has been introduced on appeal. But issue two, I didn't really have anything to say about that. I figure it follows issue one. Issue three, the jury notes. I think that's probably the most interesting one. I can't cite a proposition that says it takes two notes to show confusion, as she notes. But read that she cites doesn't really make any sense on that, because it says the jury need not re-ask the question repeatedly to find error in the circuit court's response. Okay, I accept that, but I don't think that equates to, as soon as the jury asks one question indicating some kind of confusion, you got to answer it. And I'm about to discuss, I think that the trend is going to go away from that. In Lewis, which we did cite, they said the jury's two questions regarding a definition of three material words made it explicit they were having difficulties. And then three paragraphs later, they reemphasized two notes in quick succession established it was confused. We don't have that here. We have questions that were invited, in my opinion, by the comments, by the arguments of counsel. The jury took its job seriously. If they would ask the question twice, maybe. And lastly, before my time runs out, she calls Keith versus Wade, which I cite at the end, irrelevant, and its holding is in jeopardy. Well, of course, it's on appeal, but I think it's very relevant. And they did short shrift of all the prior cases prior to 1996, which was Landauer, Childs, Oden, Camille, Browder. They kind of summarily distinguished those, and then they talk about two more recent cases, Sperry and Coots. And that's going to be before the Supreme Court. They granted it in September. That should provide some guidance on this. Because I'm just speculating, but maybe they just looked at all that old stuff, or they read the dissent in Landauer, which makes a lot of sense to me. And they said, you know what? We're just going to kind of summarily dispose of those, go on to this, and we'll see what maybe the Supreme Court says. But this business about a jury asking one question, and then you get in there and start retooling it. And the other cases, it's usually like more complicated issues before them, or the jury instructions were incomplete, sometimes jacked like that, but just not, I think these three questions are not ones that all up there ask. I think the jury paid close attention, wanted to get it right. I hope everything else is adequately covered in my brief. If there are any questions.
I do want to go back to that earlier question.
Yes,
you cited a reference to a former justice, or you cited a case or two, and it went back fairly quickly. But those cases address the adequacy of a charging document to inform a defendant sufficient to prepare defense to those charges. They don't address what I think might be the facts in this case, is the defendant is charged under a statute that is no longer in effect.
That is correct. But the legislature retained and kept in effect the substance of what was previously resisting and obstructing. They just pocketed it under obstructing. And that's addressed in the brief.
True. Well, we all read your briefs. I understand that.
Sorry.
I'm just not sure how we get around the fact that while what you say is true, and the legislature did keep some of the language, they specifically in the next enactment separated and redefined resisting.
Yes, sir.
So it no longer reads resisting or obstructing, it reads resisting arrest specifically with
yes, sir.
Delineation.
Yes, sir. And on the surplusage, I think the way it was charged, the manner it was charged, they obviously weren't aware of the amendment. So if you look at the charge as it was, if there was any confusion, they could just say resisting and look, it's obstructing under the new statute. That was my point I was trying to make, I guess.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Counsel.
Yes, if you affirm. Thanks.
Counsel, your rebuttal.
May it please the Court. I just wanted to briefly read the information to highlight how striking resisting, knowingly resisted from the information still leaves questions about whether he was convicted of resisting or obstructing, because counsel did not continue reading the information where it says, in that said defendant refused to obey the officer's verbal commands, pulled away from the officer, and continued to actively physically resist the officer's attempts to control the defendant. From the very start of the case, from the charging document to the state's closing, the state proceeded on both resisting and obstructing, and I think the record is very, very clear on that. And unless Your Honors have any other further questions, we just ask that this court reverse and vacate the conviction, because Mr. Hermanson has the due process right to know what he was convicted of. And the state cannot charge a defendant in this disjunctive way and then ask that this court go back and fill in the blanks and choose which conviction the jury convicted on when we don't have any of that information. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Counsel. Justice Hackett?
No, sir. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Counsel. Obviously, we'll take the matter under advisement. We will issue an order in due course.